Hi, this is Les Morgan with Growth House. Today I'm interviewing Dr. Stanley Terman. Dr. Terman is a psychiatrist and MD. Dr. Terman, thanks for being with us today on Growth House Radio.
Les, thanks for having me.
Dr. Terman, can you briefly give me some information about your experience with end-of-life care?
Sure. I've been a psychiatrist for about 30 years, and I've really emphasized relationships more than any other area. But I found about 10 or 12 years ago that the healing that needs to go on when time is limited for individuals and for families is the most critical time. So I became very intensely interested for the last 10 or 12 years in helping people who are terminally ill and their families have peaceful transitions.
Dr. Terman, you've written a book entitled The Best Way to Say Goodbye. And one of the issues in the book is the voluntary refusal of food and fluids at the end of life. Can you tell me more about that?
I'd be glad to. Voluntary refusal of food and fluid is at one and the same time both conventional and revolutionary. Prior to the introduction of medical technology, people very often died by ceasing all intake of food and fluid. Now we have tubes that can enter the body in a variety of places, and we can maintain people for many years. Case in point, 15 years for Terry Schiavo. The question is, just because we can, should we? And the revolutionary aspects of the book is to suggest that there may be times when we want to refuse food and fluid, not only by tubes, but perhaps also even if we have the ability to swallow.
Do you encourage patients to use voluntary refusal of food and fluids?
Oh, I never encourage patients to hasten their dying or to do anything that would lead to an earlier death. What I do is to present to the patient my professional knowledge of what the options are from which they can choose.
Dr. Terman, when people are dying, they naturally stop eating and drinking very often. Isn't that correct?
That is correct.
In other words, they're able to still eat and drink, but they just choose to stop doing it. I've seen this happen with hospice patients. Have you seen that happen? And medically, what's going on when people stop eating and drinking?
Well, of course, it depends upon the diagnosis. Patients who are terminally ill with cancer often lose their appetite and often lose their ability or wish to continue to hydrate as well. They just don't want to put anything else in their bodies because it makes them feel sicker. And we have learned a lot from alert terminally ill cancer patients about what that feels like. Other patients may decide that even though they can still enjoy eating and swallow perfectly well, they have a rather dismal future to look forward to. For example, they may, if they were to survive another 2 or 3 months, have excruciating pain in their bones from, for example, cancer. Or they may be only days or maybe a week away from dying, and they would prefer to die by dehydration instead of by untreated pneumonia with all the toxic effects of a fever and shortness of breath and coughing. So that sometimes people just lose their appetite and a desire for fluid, and sometimes they may retain that, but they have made a choice that it would be more peaceful to die by voluntary dehydration than by another way.
So I'm trying to distinguish two situations. In one situation, you have what might be called natural dying process, in which the body itself turns off its desire to eat and drink.
Correct.
And that happens in a lot of people who are dying.
Especially if they have cancer.
Another category is people who still have the ability to eat and drink, but they've chosen not to eat and drink because they're concerned about the course that their disease is going to take and how difficult the final stage of dying will be for them. So in effect, they stop eating and drinking voluntarily, and they die as a result of it. Because if you don't eat or drink, you're going to die. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
Isn't that a form of suicide?
I believe that it's not. As a psychiatrist, I am totally against suicide, but I define suicide as someone who is medically well, who has a full life ahead of him or her, and who for emotionally based reasons that are irrational wants to end their lives. In contrast, a terminally ill patient, if given the choice, would say, if you could take away my disease and if you could take away my suffering, I would love to live. But the reality is, I have this disease. It's irreversible. It's progressive. It's going to kill me. It's going to kill me in an awful way. And I have a choice. It is not committing suicide. It is a decision to not prolong the process of dying. We're all mortal. We will all die someday. And for some of us facing the last chapter of life, we know that that day is going to come sooner than later. When we get to the point where we have a definite terminal diagnosis and we know what the prognosis is, just as we can decide what kind of treatment we would like when we're well to feel even better, we can also decide what kind of way we want to exit from this life. And stopping eating and drinking is one way that can not prolong our dying process. Sometimes when people stop eating and drinking, it's the underlying disease that takes over. Sometimes it is the change in electrolytes that occur and other factors due to the proximate cause of stopping eating and drinking, and sometimes we can't tell. But what's important is that if a person wants to choose a method of dying that is peaceful, then they should be able to do so.
So this is a voluntary acceleration of one's death, is that correct?
Or it's, you could say it that way, or you could say it's a voluntary act so that the process of dying is not prolonged. Sometimes it's very difficult for a terminally ill patient to eat, even though they can. They can eat, they can even enjoy it to some extent, but it's an effort. And sometimes they feel a great relief when they just say, okay, I'm done with that part of my life. As people enter their last chapter of their lives, they give up things. And one of the things they give up is the pleasure of eating and drinking.
Dr. Terman, your specialty is psychiatry. How do you know that they're not just depressed when they want to stop eating and drinking?
In fact, that's one of the most important things to rule out, that they are realistically depressed and not psychotically depressed. And there are different kinds of depression in the psychiatric diagnostic and statistical manual. Someone who is psychotically depressed has a view of reality that is not based in fact. They may think that they're a terrible person, or they have this terrible guilt, or that they're a burden on people, and they may be medically well and still take their lives, when if they could be treated, they could live a noble lifespan. Someone who has a diagnosis of a terminally ill illness, who has only to look forward to much more pain, much more suffering, where their hours of every day are consumed with only medical treatment and there's no pleasure left, can make a reasonable choice to not prolong the process of dying, which some people would call hastening dying.
Is this an example of what some people used to call rational suicide?
Yes, that term has been used.
What does that term mean, and how does it differ from what we're talking about here?
Rational suicide means you take into consideration what your future existence has in store for you. If the burdens of living, of existing, far exceed the benefits, if all you have to look forward to is far more suffering and pain, with decreasing if there's pleasure at all, then what point is there to prolong the process of dying when you have a way to shorten it by voluntarily refusing food and fluid?
But many people would say that's just wrong. It's never appropriate to shorten your own life.
Yes, some people say that you should try to use every method available to extend life for as long as possible. And sometimes these people come from the Orthodox or fundamentalist religions. But we must remember that there are theologists who disagree, and also it is a sin in their own theology to prolong life when God decides that it is time to take the person to heaven.
If a patient came to you and they said, I know I'm going to die of X within the next couple of months, I've decided to blow my brains out, how would you feel about that?
Terrible. I think blowing one's brains out is perhaps extremely painful, though briefly. It is violent. It uses an instrument that could be used inappropriately and kill someone else who has a full life ahead of him or her. It is unsightly and unaesthetic. Doesn't make for an open casket. And worst of all, it's irreversible. When a patient maintains that resolve of refusing food and fluid over several days, everybody knows that they really meant it to be that time. Once you take 90 grams of secanol, it's over. You can't say, wait a second, I changed my mind. Well, you can in the first few seconds, first few minutes, and then you get the pumps out and the charcoal and the ventilator and the mechanical breathing assistance, but that rarely happens.
Is it possible that people who are anorexic would choose this approach?
They do, and they have, and one of the things that must be ruled out is whether the person who says, I want to stop eating and drinking, suffers from the psychosis called anorexia nervosa. There is an anorexia that occurs due to cancer. Anorexia means just a wasting of and a total lack of appetite. If someone, say a young lady in her late teens or early 20s, is not eating and drinking, that is a medical emergency as well as a psychiatric emergency. That person should be put on tube feeding, even if it's involuntary, even if they don't want to, because the state has a vested interest in preserving life, and treated aggressively psychiatrically as well, so that they can return to functioning and live out a full and normal lifespan.
If you've ruled out depression and you've ruled out anorexia, is that it?
No, there's one other thing you must do, and that is to determine that the patient has decisional capacity, which is the ability to use their mind to make a prudent and sound medical decision. And that is based on that they understand what the options are, they appreciate the consequences of the alternatives that they may choose from, they use reasoning to derive a choice, and then they express that choice, and not just once, but consistently. Sometimes I will interview someone for 2 hours at the beginning, at the end, want to see the same answer, and then have them come back 5 days later and see that they still are consistent. By the way, understanding, appreciation, reasoning, and expressing is capital U-A-R-E, you are. So that when I teach this to other clinicians, they can remember how to formulate their clinical investigation of the capacity to make prudent, sound medical decisions.
If you've made this clinical investigation and have ruled that the patient is competent, legally they have the right to choose this, don't they?
They absolutely have the right to do that, because under the 14th Amendment of the Constitution, where we have our liberty interest, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, we have the right to say what does and does not happen to our bodies, including what people put into it or don't put into it. So if I say I don't want to eat or drink, you can't force me to eat or drink unless I'm not competent.
So if you are competent and you've decided you don't want it, it's enforceable as a medical decision on your part?
Absolutely. The U.S. Supreme Court in 1990, among other things in the case of Nancy Cruzan, stated that every competent adult has the constitutional right to refuse any medical treatment.
Now, if you lose the ability to express that later on, maybe you have lost consciousness, this has to be documented clearly in an advance directive.
Yes, it does have to be. And it has to be clear and convincing, and you have to be pretty precise about what conditions you want to refuse food and fluid. But you see, you do not lose your constitutional right to refuse treatment to maintain the integrity of your body just because you've lost the ability to express yourself. You can defer that decision-making ability to a designated proxy who can speak on your behalf later on. It's important to have advance care planning with your family, with your proxy or surrogate or agent, and with your physician to understand what your options are and to choose among them.
But if a medical provider helps with this in any way, is that assisted suicide?
The medical provider is assisting only to provide comfort care. And the American Society has a code of ethics which very clearly say that when the physician's duty is in conflict between A, extending life, and B, reducing suffering, and both cannot occur at the same time, then the choice is up to the patient.
Do you know of any cases where a medical provider has been aware that a patient is refusing food and fluid and they've been prosecuted for not intervening?
Absolutely not.
That's a pretty short answer.
That is the answer.
The concept of clear and convincing evidence is a legal concept that's been introduced into all of this. What it basically does is to introduce a higher standard of evidence for some medical decisions than others. And in some areas, removal of a feeding tube is required to have clear and convincing evidence. New York State is an example. Is that correct? And what's your understanding of this?
Not only is it correct, but in New York State, you can authorize your proxy to make all kinds of medical decisions for you globally, but they cannot refuse either artificial or oral administration of food and fluid unless you specifically grant them that authority.
So if you are planning on doing this, it's a good idea to put it in writing, is that right?
Absolutely, or you can put it on a recording.
But this must be difficult for the family to see because they think that if the patient doesn't eat, they're going to die. But in fact, what's happening is they're dying, so they're not eating.
And also, our culture is always to provide nurturance to the people we love. So many ceremonies have to do with food and other liquids like wine, for example.
But there are negative side effects of eating and drinking when persons are dying because their body doesn't process food and fluid the same way it used to.
That's correct.
For example, if you have congestive heart failure but you drink a lot of liquid and there's no ability to get rid of the liquid, you're going to feel like you're drowning because your lungs become congested.
In fact, Joanne Lynn has for over 20 years been educating professionals that when one stops, when a terminally ill patient stops eating and drinking, their comfort level increases in so many ways, in so many organ systems. If your lungs are functioning better, you get more oxygen to your brain. Your brain also has less fluid, so you, surprisingly, people become more lucid in the first few days of that fast, and then that adds to the beauty of their sharing and exchanging memories and final goodbyes.
Kathleen Singh, in her book, The Grace in Dying, says that dying is an inherently safe procedure, and much of the problems arise because we interfere with it. In the case of eating and drinking, that can in some cases be a type of interference in the body's natural effort to reduce its hydration level. So when we hydrate the body, sometimes these negative side effects really are not well understood by the family. And so they force fluids on people when really the patient might be more comfortable if they didn't have them.
There's a lot of education that needs to be done, even among physicians. And studies have shown that the less experience a physician has in end-of-life care, the more likely he or she is to overhydrate to the burden of the patient. Thirst is a symptom, but it's a symptom that can be solved. And the family has to learn how to approach the patient. For instance, you don't ask the patient, would you like something to drink? We don't even ask the patient, are you thirsty? We ask the patient, is your mouth dry? Ah, it is dry. Okay, now you have a choice. You have a choice of receiving one of the thirst-reducing aids, which actually treats the symptom of dry mouth, or you can have something to drink. And when we've had prior discussions repeatedly over time and established what the patient wants, we know that they can remain consistently in their resolve to accept the thirst-reducing aids to reduce the symptoms of dry mouth instead of drinking any fluid. It turns out that even a little fluid to wash down a pill several times a day can prolong the process of dying from, say, the usual 1 to 2 weeks to 3 or 4 weeks. It is a decision that is made over a series of several days. Every day, the patient has to maintain their resolve and say, no breakfast today, no lunch today, no dinner today, no food, no fluid today. Meanwhile, they're becoming more lucid and communicative very frequently. Meanwhile, I encourage all the family members to say, support the patient, your loved one, in what they're doing, but always remind them that they're not a burden, and if they want to change their minds and have something to eat or drink, they can always do this a week or a month or 3 months from now.
So there's lots of ways to back out of the decision.
Absolutely. Up to a certain point, the process is totally reversible. Well, I know that myself because I had 2 fasts, 1 4 days and 1 5 of food and 3 of food and fluid. And although my kidneys got a little tired of the process, I'm still alive and well to talk about it today.
Sometimes people insist upon feeding someone because they think that it's killing them not to feed them.
Perhaps the best way for me to answer your question about what does the family do to help at the end of life. When I was with my stepmother, when my stepfather was dying, and she kept on asking me, what can I do, what can I do? And this was after we had asked him, do you want us to treat your dry mouth with thirst-reducing aids, or do you want something to drink? And he said, just the aids. Now here's a woman whose life was in the kitchen, making chicken soup and so many other things, and that was her way of nurturing people, very common. It's very important to give family members a means of showing their love. And the way they can do that is to learn how to use the thirst-reducing aids, so that instead of pouring susticol down the throat of a person who's going to choke on it or become bloated and more uncomfortable, you learn how to use McKesson swabs that have glycerin and lemon. They can use Vaseline or Aquaphor on the lips. They can use a biotin liquid or gel. One is a drop, the other is that can be spread around with the tongue, or some other aids that can really, they can feel important as they apply them. They can feel that they're helping to reduce the suffering, and they feel that they're part of the process to nurture, but in a different way.
What about ice chips?
Sometimes patients can get relief from ice chips, but I would not want to offer it first, and I certainly would not want to overdo it, because these little chips can add up, and the more water that they become, the longer the process of dying takes. And we have to accept that death is inevitable, and the goal is for it to be peaceful and timely. And people can last for a very long time just drinking liquids. And so between a long time and a moderate time is, you know, using too much liquid.
The idea that someone will voluntarily stop eating and drinking in order to speed up dying is going to upset a lot of people. Do you find that it's a controversial idea?
Well, I think it's controversial and it's misunderstood and it's also mischaracterized. One of the misconceptions about refusing food and fluid is that it would be very painful. And actually, there's been some adverse publicity about that in the controversy over Terry Schiavo, where one of our congressmen said that it was cruel and barbaric starvation, which is an absolute mischaracterization. It's one of the most peaceful ways to die, and that's been shown over and over again in research and clinical studies. In fact, hunger is not a problem, and that's because the body naturally produces ketones that provide a slight euphoria, a state of well-being, which is a natural response to the lowered intake of calories. Dry mouth produces symptoms that are quite solvable.
Medically, I've been told that when people do this, they go into something called ketosis. What's that?
The breakdown products of certain metabolites end up as ketones. Ketones provide a slight euphoria that makes you feel a little bit better than usual, and you have experience. It actually activates the opioid system in the brain so that you have a pain relief. And instead of hunger, you feel even better.
It produces a sort of euphoria.
And we know from many studies of observing clinicians who are really tuned in to these patients that when a patient who is suffering from end-stage dementia has his or her food and fluid withheld, they actually increase their comfort over the next 2 weeks.
In advanced dementia, some people require assisted feeding. Can you discuss that?
Sure, I'd love to. I think this is an area that's very important because it's going to affect so many people, and it also has a bit of controversy surrounding it. You know, when someone can no longer swallow, and we can show this by doing swallowing tests with fluoroscopy and so forth, we say, okay, the physical ability to swallow has been lost, and therefore, if tube feeding is not going to help, then we can let the patient die naturally. And one of the phrases that I like to use, because I think it characterizes the process, is we permit natural dying. Well, what if the person doesn't know what to do with a bowl of puree or a glass of liquid with a straw in it? Well, they've lost the mental ability to eat and feed themselves. At the same time, they may be in psychic horror. They may for hours a day be screeching, mommy, daddy, and live in angst. They may feel that the kind nurse who comes over to the bed with a warm spongy soap to bathe them and clean them is an assault. What anguish these patients live in because they don't understand. Why should we open their mouths and put food at the posterior end part of their tongue so that they swallow by reflex so that we could prolong this process of dying? Why can't we just let nature take its course to permit natural dying? For people who are terminally ill with dementia, tube feeding really has no benefit. One of the surprising things is that people think, well, if I can't swallow and I'm choking on food that's going through my mouth and I run the risk of getting pneumonia and dying from aspiration pneumonia, well, then wouldn't a tube help if it went directly into my stomach? And it's not very intuitive, but the statistics of clinical medicine show that people who have tubes have just as much trouble with aspiration pneumonia as people who are fed by the mouth.
Dementia is very common, isn't it?
Very common. And it will become increasingly so. Four times as many people will be suffering from dementia in 2050 as are currently suffering, which is from 5 to 20 million. And 43% of those will need total care in a facility.
That's going to be expensive, isn't it?
Enormously expensive. When I learned that the figure estimated today, which is probably an underestimate, that it's going to cost $1 trillion every year for the cost of Alzheimer's and related dementias by the year 2050. I really didn't know what that figure meant. And I kept on asking my colleagues, economists, friends, and so forth, what kind of a framework can I put that in? Well, in the first 5 years of this Iraq war, the United States has only spent only less than a half a trillion. Well, can you imagine what it's going to do to the economy to have to spend $1 trillion every year on Alzheimer's, dementias, and related diseases?
Some people would say that not providing nutrition or hydration to someone who can't get it on their own when they're dying is a form of euthanasia. What do you think about that?
Well, in fact, in the March of 2004, Pope John Paul II did say that if a person is in a permanent vegetative state, that to not continue tube feeding would be euthanasia by omission. And the present Pope would say that even if they are for sure never going to return to conscious life, we should continue to provide nurturing sustenance that way. Interestingly, Pope John Paul II refused a feeding tube for himself, and so did Mrs. Billy Graham. Not all theologists and spiritual and religious leaders agree with that point of view. Kevin O'Rourke is a scholar and a bioethicist, a Dominican priest, and he goes along with that idea that when someone no longer can have personal relationships and cannot express themselves and they've lost the ability to understand how to eat and drink, then it's time to permit natural dying. And so does John Harvey, another Catholic theologian and also a physician and bioethicist.
So opinions vary among bioethicists on this.
And that's true. And if we go back to Pope Pius XII, he said it should be a choice made by the individual, not by the religious leader. And it should take into account not only the burden of the patient, but also the burden to the family and society.
Some medical staff feel that insertion of a tube is what they call medically futile. Are you familiar with that terminology, and what does it mean?
Yes. I'll tell you what it means. A procedure or an intervention that is called a medically futile treatment is one that has almost no chance of restoring the patient to a level of functioning where he can have a quality of life and live somewhat independently of constant, continued medical treatment.
And if something is medically futile, are the healthcare providers under a duty to provide it, or how does that work?
They are not under a duty to provide it. There is, in the California Probate Code, two exceptions to providing treatment that patients may ask for. One is if the physician believes that the treatment would be ineffective, would be a burden far more than a benefit or no benefit at all, that is medically futile. And the other is if they have a moral or religious objection by virtue of their conscience.
But laws vary by state, don't they?
They do, but most states have similar laws.
What's the situation in Texas?
In Texas, they really have a futile treatment clause that has, if you will, teeth in it. Not only does it say that the physician is not obligated to provide the treatment, but that the family has the obligation to find another provider, another physician, or another institution where that treatment will be provided. Otherwise, that treatment can be withdrawn.
Another psychiatric issue may be that people vary in the amount of control they like to exert on their environment. Some people, when they're dying, just accept it as God's will. They say, well, I'm along for the ride, but I'm not able to control it. Others are very concerned about the loss of control. How does this issue affect what you're proposing?
One of the arguments for retaining the option to legalize physician-assisted suicide is for people who need to be in control. They want to have a party on a certain day, and they want that day to be the day that they die. When it comes to voluntary refusal of food and fluid, you probably know the week, but not the day. So if a person really has a great need to be in control, they may opt for physician-assisted suicide, which of course is legal only in the state of Oregon. If I were practicing in the state of Oregon and someone came to me and asked for physician-assisted suicide there and had a control issue, I would say, can we talk about your need to be in control? Why is it so important for you to be in control? Is this a special day in your life? Is it your 20th wedding anniversary? I mean, what's going on here? But this is the final, ultimate decision that we have to make. It should be diligent. It should be made over a period of time. And if you have a control issue, let's talk about it.
You've also said that knowing that you can choose to not eat and drink might actually cause people to live longer. Is that right?
Life's greatest irony is that the freedom to control when we die can and often does lead to our choosing to live longer. If society, if clinical medicine, if the way our laws would work could assure people that when they get to a certain point, their lives, their existence will not be unnecessarily prolonged, where the burden greatly exceeds the benefit, then they will live up to that point. And if they can't be so assured, then they may end their lives prematurely. And that gets into what I would call suicide. And that's what Jack Kevorkian did with Janet Atkins, his first patient. She was 54 years old, and she couldn't teach history anymore. She couldn't play piano anymore. But she could play tennis and played a full set with her son and enjoyed it, but couldn't keep score. And then she died in that rusty old van. And her husband said that if she had known that there had been a way to live those extra 2 or 3 years with some degree of pleasure and be sure that it wouldn't have been more than that, then she would have taken that option. When you appoint a proxy and you say, look, these are my criteria. When I can no longer recognize the people I love, when I can no longer remember my values and my life and my events and what I stood for, and so on and so forth, then I want you to withhold food and fluid from me, then you can live up to that point. And that's saving a quality of life, and that's very important.
Is this mercy killing?
It's the exact opposite of mercy killing. In fact, so much money has been spent on political campaigns to legalize physician-assisted dying, where it's failed so many times in so many states. And there's another movement in the state of Washington right now. I wish that even one-tenth of that amount of money could go to educating people on voluntary refusal of food and fluid and withholding of food and fluid by proxy. Because sometimes, out of love, people commit mercy killings and the result is so tragic. Let me give you an example. Albert Pollock had a wife of 60 years of total devotion and love. She was suffering from advanced dementia, from Parkinson's disease, refusing pills and pushing away any efforts to make her comfortable. He got the clear as he could message, because they didn't know about voluntary refusal of food and fluid beforehand, because they didn't have a proxy directive written beforehand, that she wanted to no longer prolong her existence. So he strangled her with a towel, called 911, and took a plea bargain to second-degree manslaughter. So this 84-year-old loving man will spend the next 12 years in prison if he survives that long. This is not an isolated case, Les. And my heart goes out to these people. If they had only known that all she had to do was to refuse food and fluid, and all Albert had to do was to keep her mouth moist, then no one would have to go to jail.
It seems these issues that you're working on are involved with the right to die issues in general. Is that the way you see it?
I don't see it exactly that way. I see it more as the right to choose the way we die so that it can be as peaceful as possible. And sometimes we can make decisions that will either prolong the process of dying and it will be accompanied by more pain and suffering, or we can choose to permit natural dying, which will lead to a perhaps shorter time, but most importantly, with less pain and suffering.
Dr. Terman, thank you for being with me today on Growth House Radio.
It was a pleasure to be here. I'm so glad you asked such great questions and gave me the opportunity to express my views.
This is Les Morgan. Visit www.growthhouse.org to hear this interview.